One is a faithful, if dry, adaptation of William Shakespeare's classic tragedy. The other is a more modern take that takes a few liberties, such as the concept of a brake pedal. Romeo and Juliet, they remade it. Hi, and welcome back to another episode of They Remade It. I'm your host, Stuart.
And I'm your host, Jacob.
Just another lovely evening in, well, I guess afternoon in, you know, at time of recording is February. The birds are shining, the birds are shining? God, it's been a bit of a morning. It's been weird just because I've been watching the news lately and things just aren't going great in a lot of places, so.
I thought you were doing that on purpose.
Nope, like, I am.
The birds are shining, the sun is chirping. I thought it was going to be a fun little...
You know, if I had any amount of showmanship and ability to continue on with my own gaffes, I probably could have done that. But the fact of the matter is, I have a brain run by,
We'll fill that in later.
Well.
This is Jacob's note to the They Remade It editing staff. I don't know which one of you is going to be handling this, but please put something fun in there, in that little gap.
Yeah, just like some ragtime or something. Act like it literally came out of my mouth. It's like, whoa.
Whoa, what was that that just happened in real time?
Surprise, everyone has a secret superpower in the world, and mine is to generate small snippets of ragtime. It's honestly
very
not great.
Useful.
Where the fuck is this already gone? Whatever. What have you been watching?
Let me pull up my thing here. You caught me off guard. For some reason, I always have this stuff in my notes, but I didn't this time. I did stuff.
Can you tell it's been a weird couple of months for us folks? 2022 has been weird.
It hasn't even been bad. It's been weird. I mean, there's aspects that are bad, but I haven't really been affected.
Yeah. Like gas prices are kind of annoying. I guess that's kind of the extent of it for me.
What is gas? Well, I've been working from home, so I haven't experienced, I know of it, but thankfully I haven't experienced it firsthand all too much. I've been watching a few things, rewatching some things, playing some things. I finally got around to playing through and completing Metroid Dread, which I had been holding off for a while until I went back to some Metroid. I wanted to go back to a couple of Metroid titles before I did Dread. I've played Super Metroid before, but I don't think I had ever beaten it, so I went ahead and beat it, and that was a lot of fun. I played the original Metroid on NES for the first time, and I was like, wow, this game is hot garbage. I can't believe that this ever caught on, that they were like, you know what, we should make a sequel to this on the Game Boy.
Yeah,
sequel in the SNES.
Yeah, having gone back and actually played a few things, which one of which I'll talk about here in a bit, I truly don't understand how older titles ever could have been popular enough to become like these, like generation spanning classics, because most of them straight up suck. Like, not even like, oh, at the time this was kind of revolutionary. I can't imagine how at the time this was anything other than hot garbage.
Right. No, I agree. I think for Metroid's sake, the music and the atmosphere that it manages to create are probably what made it sort of stick, if in anyone's mind, but like just the gameplay and the controls, I'm like, this is fucking awful. Like, I've played allegedly like horrible NES games that I enjoyed playing more than I played when I played Metroid. But anyways, Dread is good. It's a lot of fun. I kind of wish that they didn't have the sections where the robots chase you around, because my favorite parts of those games is exploring, and that functionality deliberately quarantines large sections of the map.
As if we didn't need more quarantine in our lives.
Exactly. Can you believe it?
Topical humor. Ha ha ha.
It was very topical, but it's just frustrating because it's like there's this zone there that you can step into, but you have to immediately leave it because you cannot defeat these robots until you attain a specific upgrade, which is also a little tedious because you have to do the same thing 6 times.
Yeah, I've never played any of the Metroids myself. I've never really been a fan. I know there was a few that were like first person that I briefly played. I never got the appeal. And so all this commentary, like that's been the general consensus I've heard before of being like, this is really cool, except for like the giant robot bits. And every time I think back on that, I think about all the trailers. It's like, it seemed like that was the prime selling point for the new one. And so it's like, wow, I don't know what the fuck people want.
I think that was the prime selling point because it's, besides some move upgrades, it's the only new mechanic that they're introducing in this Metroid title. But it's also, it's kind of sparse. Like, you get to points where it's like 3 hours of gameplay between those robot segments. I'm like, this is great. It's just Metroid. It's just like Super Metroid. I'm having fun. I don't know. Could have done without those. But anyways, so I played through that. And I played a bunch of other stuff here and there, but I watched 2 new things, both of which I saw in theaters. I saw the new Jackass movie, Jackass Forever. I saw really? It in theaters. I did. There's something about that stuff. I don't know. I actually do find that stuff kind of funny because it's just like dumb shit like YouTube videos or America's Funniest Home Videos, but in a theatrical setting, which doesn't sound appealing, but I've always enjoyed it. I didn't like the Jackass TV show, even though it's basically the same shit. I don't know. Who knows what I want? My brain's fucked. But
I mean, I could have told you that.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun seeing the reviews for it because I don't know. There, anything can have criticism, but some of these reviews are like, they were expecting high art. It's like this series and franchise has been around since like 2000. And I guess it's people discovering it for the first time that are like, this is hot garbage. Like,
yeah, no,
I guess that's fine. But
yeah,
I don't know what you were expecting. The trailer didn't make it to be anything that it wasn't. And these people are like, I was shocked and appalled. It's like, okay.
It's Johnny Knoxville, for God's sake, a man with a name that sounds like a porn name, and a man who himself, I'm pretty sure, has actually shown up in some porns.
Possibly. I don't think it's all that surprised.
I don't know for sure because it seems like I've seen it somewhere before where it was like, oh, Johnny Knoxville was in like having like an active participation thing. And it's just like he's just there.
What, standing in the background eating a grapefruit? Like, it's
I think it must have been like one of those like ones that are actually like purportedly meant to be like an actual like adult movie where there's actually like a plot and shit. So it's, I guess, more of a softcore thing,
like Down and Dirty Duck. And
I guess I will assume that's one. The fact that you were able to name one right off
Rabbit.
The fact that you were able to immediately name one off your head, I was like, okay. Which, no judgment, obviously.
I've seen a number of those in my time, and this is like a stock internet thing, but none of those times was it for sexual gratification. It's always because those things are reported to have just bizarre plots, and they usually do.
Yeah, I mean, they're meant to justify people having sex, so.
Mm-hmm. But anyways.
Anyway, Jackass.
All that talk aside, I watched it. I had fun. It's nothing that it doesn't purport itself to already be. And Steve-O's looking good, which is great. It seems he's kept all that awfulness in his life.
Yeah, I was never directly involved with any of that stuff. Or I say directly involved as if I actually knew Steve-O. But like, I was never like, knowledgeable about that subject. I just knew about Steve-O just in general, like after the fact. I'm like, oh, you know, I don't know who this guy is, but I'm happy that he's doing okay.
Yeah, it's nice to see. It's good to see. Yeah. And the last new thing I saw, I just saw last night. I wouldn't have talked about it had we recorded on Wednesday.
Oh, yeah, sorry, we had to reschedule.
No, it's fine. So last night I did see the Uncharted movie in theaters.
Oh God.
Uh-huh.
That alone tells me everything I need to know.
It's pretty average. I don't want to go into a long diatribe. I have a lot of complicated thoughts on it. It's weird because I write reviews for Letterboxd whenever I see a movie, and it's usually like two or three sentences, but I left like three paragraphs for this one.
Wow.
And it's not even that it's outright terrible. It's just average in the way you expect video game movies to either be average or less than.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like, this is fine. You know, some of the conversationalized relationships are, you know, they got the dialogue between Tom Holland and Mark Wahlberg pretty down. The humor is actually there. It's just, my main takeaway point is whenever a movie adaptation of a pre-existing property comes out, they always have to turn it into an origin story, and I don't give a shit. Before the trailers came out, this movie was announced like 10 years ago, and they've been working on it since. I was hoping it would just be the pre-existing relationship between these characters dropped into the middle of an adventure, like, you know, Uncharted 1 and 2. 3 went a little bit heavy on the backstory, and 4 went way heavy on the backstory, but
it kind of earned
it. It feels unnecessary. Well, at that point, yeah, because they already have these characters, so you kind of want to know more about their lives, but they're like, they act as if people who've never played the games before are gonna sit through this movie for 30 minutes and be like, well, this is fine, but how did Nate get here? What is his story?
Like, for fuck's sake, we didn't get origins about Indiana Jones until the third movie, and it was only for about 15 minutes. Like,
yeah.
Jesus wept. I still blame Disney and Marvel in general on that shit of like this fascination with origin stories.
I hate it so much. Even Sonic did it, and I like the Sonic movie, but they did Sonic, it a little bit.
The Sonic movie at least kind of gets away with it for the fact that it is such a unique story on its own that they're basically just taking a pre-existing character and just doing whatever the fuck they want with it, and then it's like, okay, fine, like, we got to have at least some setup here. But then with Uncharted, it's like, this is a very distinct character that's had a lot of games and a lot of development. People who have played the games know what the fuck is up, and people who haven't played the games probably just want to see him at his best. The writing tip that I will always like remember is, whenever you're either watching or reading something, is this the most interesting part of this character's life? If the answer is no, why aren't we seeing that? And it's just,
and it's not. I can tell you for a fact, it's definitely not.
I'm pretty sure I had kind of briefly seen like some details from like some of the trailers. What is it like meant to be, like the Lost Gold of Magellan or something?
It's supposed to be, yeah, it's supposed to be Magellan's gold. To be honest, the entire movie, a lot of the set dressing and like the quote unquote puzzles and just different various scenes, it takes more from Uncharted 4 than any other game in the series. Just strange, like, the Magellan's gold aspect in and of itself is supposed to be a substitute for the Avery pirate plot. Like, there's the crosses, the boats, like, it's that specifically. They just modified it a little bit, which I'm not saying I hate that or anything. It's just that's sort of what it is.
I will say, though, in fairness, the lost Magellan's gold, that is an actual apparent, like, lost treasure. And so, like, that's, okay, yeah. Fair enough. That's a pretty classic one. But in response to all this, the fact that the fucking full budget movie that was like, eh, okay, is using the same plot setup as the fan made one that had Nathan Fillion in it as Nathan Drake. Cause like that was the goal they were looking for in that one as well. Obviously it was just like meant to be a setup thing of like one encounter along the journey. But like, I just look back on that original one. It's like, God, that one looks so cool. The guy they had for Sully, I love that actor, and he plays him perfectly. Nathan Fillion is obviously Nathan Drake. You couldn't do it any better. And then when I see fucking Tom Holland and Mark fucking Wahlberg for this, I'm like, did y'all even try? Like
that. So that's the one thing I want to say. The characters in the movie, for the most part, aren't that bad. Tom Holland actually does a it. it's that sort of flanderization thing that actors get. I know Adam West talked about it all the time with Batman, where it's hard to see him in things and not think of Spider-Man, and that's not entirely his fault. Right. But Tom Holland actually does a pretty decent job at playing a young Nathan Drake, which this is ostensibly supposed to be since they turned it into an origin story, and he's not bad. And a lot of the supporting cast is pretty great, too. The main problem is Sully is my favorite character from the games.
Yeah.
Mark Wahlberg's... It's not even Mark Wahlberg. The writing of the character, it's a completely different character.
Okay, yeah, I figured.
It's a completely different person. He's like the stock thief. Everyone's out to get me. Everyone's out to betray me. He likes treasure in the same way that Sully does, obviously. But he's like Daffy Duck levels of greedy and selfishness and... It's like, I don't know who this person is.
I was fully anticipating, like, I was so hoping, and I'll stop rambling on about this here in a sec, but I was fully hoping that the movie was going to have, like, a complete twist where the Mark Wahlberg character wasn't actually Sully, and that he was just, like, trying to impersonate Sully to bring Drake along to kind of just lead him on so that he can use him to lead him to the treasure, and then the actual Sully comes in and beats his ass. And because it was like, because they established in the trailer that they bring up Drake's brother and I figured, like, okay, Sully and the brother were doing shit together, and then Mark Wahlberg's guy came along and was like, okay, well, I'm gonna use their other brother who's also good at this shit and beat them to the punch. Like, I was fully hoping that, because even by the trailer I was like, this is not Sully, this is 100% not fucking Sullivan. I could not believe that they chose him for the role.
What about you? I don't want to get, you know, too angry.
That's fair.
The meat.
I mean, fair. This time around, I didn't watch a whole lot. I definitely played a lot more. Here recently, I actually went to visit my girlfriend in South Carolina. So, you know, spent time together. Watched a couple things. We've continued watching this one series on Dropout. That's the College Humor folks of they have their dungeons, like their D&D series Dimension 20, and they have it's a now finished series of a Crown of Candy, which is a parody of Game of Thrones, and it's like the whole thing of it's like the plot of it being that it's a realm of food people, and the center of it being it's centered on this realm of candy people. So like they live, it's basically if a kingdom were made out of Candyland, the game, and it's hilarious, and honestly, it's super duper well written to the point of being like, wow, I honestly like this more than Game of Thrones now. So that's a lot to deal with, obviously. But on the more serious end for watching things, I also took the time to watch the new Del Toro movie, Nightmare Alley, which was pretty damn good, I'll say. Visually, I think it's one of my favorites that he's ever done, because I think I have a soft spot for that general time period. Like the whole, like, it's centered on two distinct periods in this character's life, not too far separated in time, but first half centered upon him joining up with this carnival and becoming a mentalist slash magician. Mentalism being like the act of like being able to tell like what someone's thinking or what they're kind of doing or like what they're asking for from like supposed spirits from the beyond or whatever the fuck. And the second half is him going out on his own with his romantic partner slash business partner and letting all of it go to shit. And I love Bradley Cooper as a character. I think he was fantastic in it. At the same time, though, his character is meant to kind of be a piece of shit, and he does end up ruining his own life and getting comeuppance for it. The plot at times is pretty predictable. Like, every warning sign in the world is basically telling this guy, hey, don't do this thing you're about to do. You will get fucked over. He said, I shan't listen to you. He does do thing and does indeed get fucked over. And, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
As you do.
As you do. So, you know, at times it's a little predictable with things. But the way it's presented and, like, the whole plot of it being, the whole crux of it is basically them stating about how the idea of, like, folks that can, like, supposedly read minds or, like, do things with supernatural powers, it's all actually very straightforward, like, a combination of guesswork and being able to read people very well. And, like, a lot of those moments where it even explicitly goes, don't, like, to the character, hey, don't ever fall for your own shtick. If you start believing you actually have powers, you're only going to get yourself killed. And through that with the audience. There are so many moments where we're like, how the fuck did he do that? How the fuck does he do all these different things? And then they explain it after the fact. And you're like, oh, right, I kept falling for it. So I think how it's framed is beautiful. I think most of all, though, is the visuals. I think the visuals are spectacular, especially the second half, because it's set in, I think, 1941, just at the beginning of the U.S. entering World War II. And they're in some city in the Midwest. I think it might be Kansas City. And it's just the stunning kind of like that Art Deco art style and everything. Of like, they're in this one psychiatrist's office that looks like basically if you took the entirety of the Art Deco movement and distilled it into an office. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And so I think that was its biggest selling point for me. I will say, though, it's hard watching the main character be a piece of shit, because it's like at a certain point, like, well, I want to root for someone, but at the same time, I mainly just want to root for this guy to get fucked over. And in the end, he does get implied fucked over, at least. I obviously won't spoil it, but like, it's not explicitly showing him getting his like ultimate comeuppance, but it leads to the fact like he will be getting it. And so that was a little disappointing, I guess, but I think I might just be a sadist. Otherwise, though, I fucking loved it. I think it's got a lot of, like, the first half's got a lot of different, like, side characters that are played by great actors. It's got Willem Dafoe, Ron Perlman, few other folks whose names.
What, Ron Perlman in a Guillermo del Toro movie?
Yeah, he plays an old carny, which, like, wow. Of course he does. And Willem Dafoe plays a carny, which, because a fucking course he does. There's a few other guys whose names I forget, but they're fantastic actors. Overall, solid movie, probably like 8 out of 10. Definitely not his best, like, story-wise. I still think... I still honestly think Pacific Rim's his best. but, you know, it's still really good. It's very dramatic.
Well, I'll have to...
On Hulu.
I'll have to take a look. Oh, is it?
Yeah,
oh, I'll have to... I'll have to watch it. I'll have to take a look. My favorite of his is... Shape of Water is pretty good. I do like Pacific Rim too, but I think that prior to your watching Nightmare Alley, the last Del Toro picture we had both seen was Pan's Labyrinth, and we were both kind of like, eh.
Yeah, no, so that one wasn't great.
Maybe some refreshing Del Toro goodness is needed.
This one's definitely worth it. Yeah, this one, there's some catharsis with it of being like, man, they're going through the same shit we're going through in a way. beyond that, the only other thing I've been doing is playing some games. One that I kind of implied to earlier was I've been playing through the Assassin's Creed Ezio Auditore collection. So that's being the collection of Assassin's Creed 2, Brotherhood, and Revelations. I played through 2 and most of Brotherhood. I still think 2 is the quintessentially most Assassin's Creed game there is. Like, I think it nailed it for its story and its atmosphere and everything. Its controls and how well it feels when it to control is complete horse shit. And it's so glitchy at times. I'm just like, there are like problems with like audio sync and everything that have been there since the fucking game very first came out. And this is the remastered version where it's like, you couldn't have just like pushed that sound effect a little bit earlier in the scene, because it's clearly not synced up. And it's like shit like that. And like the technology jump, the polished jump from Brotherhood from 2 to Brotherhood is so noticeable, where it's like, God, they actually look like human beings now. it's janky as hell. And it's borderline unplayable in certain places, where it's just like, it's so fucking frustrating. And they also have this whole like super duper problem with putting in tons of collectible items that are straight up useless and super hard to find. And then every now and again, it actually turns out that they're actually super useful to get anything close to some level of completion. Like in the first game in 2, you have to get 100 of these feathers that are looted around the place, but they're not marked by any map you can get. And so they're just randomly all over these massive places.
Petruggio's feathers are worse mm-hmm. than the flag collection in Assassin's Creed 1, because at least they're visible. Like, yeah. you can see them for the most part.
Yeah.
But the feathers are just a pain in the ass.
Yeah, it's pretty bullshit. Also, there's a couple DLCs that came with it that I never ended up buying, and they all suck. Like, they just straight up, it just takes forever to get going. It seems pointless for the wider story. And the last chunk of it, and where you get a whole new open area in Florence, is probably one of the more frustrating ones I've ever done. I was like, I want this to stop so fucking fast. I cannot even believe it.
I honestly didn't know that. I just recompleted Assassin's Creed 2 early last year in 2021. And I didn't know there was DLC for that one. I thought that Assassin's Creed 3 was the first one to have DLC.
Nope, there's a few for 2. And again, they're just straight up not worth it. Like, they're boring and they're frustrating.
Okay. Well, I probably won't bother then. Yeah, it's funny because Okay. The only Assassin's Creed game after 4 Black Flag that I've played is Odyssey, which I still haven't finished. I need to go back to it. I just got distracted. But
honestly, I'm going to tell you, as with every other Assassin's Creed game, the ending sucks.
Well, it's no, that's fine. It's fine. I don't know if I expected any different. But that being said, I've only played like 7 of the Assassin's Creed games, which seems a lot, but there's like 50. I still think that of all the ones I've played, 2 is the best and probably my favorite, even with all its flaws. Sometimes it's easy to look past that stuff. Sometimes it's not. I mean, my favorite game is still to this point Shadow of the Colossus, and it's hard to go back and play that on the PS2 because it controls like shit. Even when you're not trying to climb and hold on to giant beasts, it's still hard to like actually move around. But I love it.
Yeah, fair enough.
So,
Assassin's Creed 4 is still my favorite just because I like being a pirate. That's literally it. Assassin's Creed 2 comes close, but I just like being a pirate.
I mean, fair.
it's definitely their best. Who written doesn't? It's their one game that isn't so totally at odds with its internal message, where like all the other ones, you're meant to be like this stoic, like badass assassin who can kill anyone, but it's meant to be this whole thing of like, you're meant to have some level of composure. Then Assassin's Creed 4 came along and was like, okay, what if we took all those abilities and shit and gave them to a literal raucous pirate and just threw them out into the world? I was like, brilliant. Fucking brilliant. Just fucking have bullshit fun with it.
You did it. You succeeded.
You finally had some decent writing, Ubisoft. Good job. Can't wait to see how you fuck it up next time.
Oh, that Ubisoft is fucking it up right now as we speak by being the only video game company that won't back down from the NFT train.
Oh god.
They're staying still. They're like, "No, NFTs are the future."
I don't understand how Ubisoft has survived. Like, I get that people keep buying the Assassin's Creed games, but they've been getting worse. I liked Odyssey just because I liked running around ancient Greece, but that is it.
Yeah. Oh. A lot of people like Valhalla.
You can't imagine why. It sounds very dull. But other than that, I've also gotten back into my addiction to Stardew Valley.
Oh, good.
That's it. That's all else I've been doing. I've just been planting my farm.
All right. Well, very eventful.
Yeah.
Our weeks have been.
My God. And now, to really just fucking put the final nail in this coffin for our weeks, it's Romeo and goddamn Juliet with the most breakneck shift in tone between the two of them. Obviously, small disclaimer at the forefront of this. I'm guessing we all know what the plot of Romeo and Juliet is at this point. We've all had high school English. So, you know, I'm just going to give the plot synopsis of courtesy of the Wikipedia page in case you guys weren't paying attention. That's where we get our synopses from. but I will be getting the plot synopses from the 1968 version of the film, and then we'll be giving the main actors and directing credits for the 1996 version of the film. So, with the 68 version, directed by Franco Zeffirelli, screenplay by Franco Brusati and Massolino D'Amico, obviously based on the work of William Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet. One summer morning in Verona, a long-standing feud between the Montague and Capulet clans breaks out into a street brawl. Brawl is broken up by the local prince, who warns both families that any future violence between them will result in harsh consequences. That night, two teenagers of the families, Romeo and Juliet, meet at a Capulet masked ball and fall in love. Later, Romeo stumbles into a secluded garden under Juliet's bedroom balcony, and the two exchange impassioned pledges. They are secretly married the next day, I keep forgetting that that's how quick it was, by Romeo's confessor and father figure, Friar Lawrence, with the assistance of Juliet's nurse. That afternoon, Juliet's cousin, Tybalt, furious that Romeo had attended his family's ball, insults him and challenges him to a brawl. Romeo now regards Tybalt as family, and he refuses to fight him, which leads to Romeo's best friend, Mercutio, to fight Tybalt in his stead. Despite Romeo's efforts to stop the fight, Tybalt mortally wounds Mercutio, who curses both Montague and Capulet houses before his death. Enraged over his friend's death, Romeo retaliates by fighting Tybalt and killing him as well. Romeo is subsequently punished by the prince with banishment from Verona, with the threat of death if he were to ever return. Romeo then secretly spends his wedding night with Juliet, and the couple consummate their marriage before Romeo flees. It should also be noted that the Wikipedia actually has a hyperlink with consummate, which I imagine just leads to a Wikipedia page describing sex. Juliet's parents, unaware of their daughter's secret marriage, have arranged for Juliet to marry the wealthy Count Paris. Juliet pleads with her parents to postpone the marriage, but they refuse and threaten to disown her if she doesn't. Juliet seeks out Friar Lawrence for help, hoping to escape her arranged marriage to Paris and remain faithful to Romeo. At Friar Lawrence's behest, she reconciles with her parents and agrees to their wishes. On the night before the wedding, however, Juliet consumes a potion prepared by Friar Lawrence, intended to make it appear she was dead for 42 hours. Friar Lawrence plans to inform Romeo of the hoax so that Romeo can meet Juliet after her burial and escape with her when she recovers from her swoon. So he sends Friar John to give Romeo a letter describing the plan. However, when Balthazar, Romeo's servant, sees Juliet being buried under the impression that she is dead, he goes to tell Romeo and reaches him before Friar John. In despair, Romeo goes to Juliet's tomb and kills himself by drinking poison. Soon afterwards, Friar Lawrence arrives as Juliet awakens. Despite his attempts to persuade her to flee from the crypt, Juliet refuses to leave Romeo. And once the friar flees, she kills herself by plunging Romeo's own dagger into her abdomen. Later, the two families, having ended their feud, attend their joint funeral and are condemned by the prince for their actions. So, going with the main cast of players, from the House Montague, we have Antonio Pierfiderici, I apologize, I'm not Italian, as Lord Montague, Esmeralda Rispioli as Lady Montague, Leonard Whitling as Romeo, Bruce Robinson as Benvolio, Keith Skinner as Balthazar, and Robbio Antonelli as Abram. We have, in the House Capulet, Paul Hardwick as Lord Capulet, Natasha Parry as Lady Capulet, Olivia Hussey as Juliet, Michael York as Tybalt, Dyson Lovell as Samson, don't know who that is, Richard Warwick as Gregory, don't know who that is, Pat Haywood as the nurse, and Roy Holder as Peter, don't know who that is. And for the remaining characters, we have John McEnery as Mercutio, we have Milo O'Shea as Friar Lawrence, Robert Stevens as the Prince of Verona, Robert Bisacco as Paris, Paola Tedesco as Rosalind, who is uncredited, and Bruno Filippini as Leonard, the singer, who is also uncredited. And then popping over to the 1996 modern interpretation, a few small notes here. There's just a few, obviously, with modern implements and everything, they've kind of replaced a few analogs. Notably, any swords they have, it's actually 9mm pistols, who are sword branded pistols, so they still call them swords, which is equal parts stupid and brilliant, so that's fun. Beyond that, it's the exact same plot. So, to that end, The 1996 version was directed by Baz Luhrmann. Screenplay was by Craig Pearce and also Baz Luhrmann. And again, based on the work of Romeo and Juliet by William Shakespeare. Rounding out the cast for this one, for the House of Montague, we have Brian Denny as Ted Montague, Romeo's father. We have Christina Pickles, that's fun, as Carolyn Montague, Romeo's mother. We have Leonardo DiCaprio as Romeo. We have Dash Mihok as Benvolio, Jesse Bradford as Balthazar, Zach Orth as Gregory, and Jamie Kennedy as Samson.
No way is that guy's name Dash Mihok.
Dash M-I-H-O-K. Dash Mihok. Mihok, you know, sorry. That's Mihok, fine by that's me. My problem. That's fantastic, though. Let's see. We have Paul Sorvino as Fulgencio Capulet, Juliet's father. Diane Venora as Gloria Capulet. I very nearly thought that said Verona for a last name. Very fun coincidence. We have Claire Danis as Juliet. We have John Leguizamo as Tybalt. Vincent Loresca as Abra. We have Carlos Martin Manzo Otalora, Jesus, as Petruchio, Juliet's cousin, and Miriam Margolis as the nurse. Then for the other characters, we have Harold Perrineau as Mercutio, Pete Postlewaite as Father Lawrence. We have Paul Rudd, of all fucking people, as Dave Paris, governor's son and the supposed Juliet fiancé for Juliet. We have Vondel Curtis Hall as Captain Prince, chief of police. Fun little replacement there as well. I'm also going to credit Edwina Moore as the anchorwoman, who assumes the role of the Greek chorus of the play. Well, not Greek chorus, just the chorus. And I think that's kind of our lot. That's kind of the whole fun thing there. Oh, well, geez, that's dark. I don't know if you want to include this in the final thing or not, but just below the cast, it also has included Natalie Portman had been cast as Juliet, but during rehearsals, it was thought that she looked too young for the part, and the footage looked as though Leonardo DiCaprio was molesting her. Baz Luhrmann also stated that Portman was too young at the time and made DiCaprio look older than intended. He was 21 at the time of filming, and Portman was only 14. Jesus. I say that as if fucking the 1968 one also didn't have that controversy. But yeah, that's your lot. There's some hard names in this.
I was going to say Claire Danes is only she was 16. So, I mean, slightly older, but yeah. There's still a 5-year gap there.
I'm fairly sure the girl in the original one was even younger. Olivia Hussey.
Probably
definitely underage, and definitely was controversy when there was straight up nudity with her.
Anyway, 17.
Okay, cool, that's at least better.
She was probably 16 when they filmed it, but 17 by the time it came out, so
anyway, that's honestly one of the lesser things Hollywood has done.
Yeah, let's talk speaking of Hollywood, let's talk a bit about that in our full circle. So, we got a decent chunk this time around, a decent chunk of names, but each one of them most of them are first-timers. I forgot about one individual. Okay, anyways, that aside, starting off with the 68 Romeo and Juliet, we have Laurence Olivier, of course, Shakespeare authoritarian himself. He was the narrator in the 68 Romeo and Juliet, and he played Zeus in 81's Clash of the Titans.
I honestly didn't even know he was the narrator. I didn't even mention him. Damn.
It was all an uncredited role for some reason. So
of all the people not to mention.
King Shakespeare himself, Laurence Sir Olivier.
Laurence Olivier, my God.
Olivia Hussey was obviously Juliet, and she played Audra Denbrough in the 1990s miniseries It.
Oh.
Who I believe was Ben's wife in the adult section.
God damn, I completely forgot about that.
I was like, I don't remember the characters' names. I think that's
right. Whatever.
Yeah. Salvatore Billa or Bia, maybe, if it's Spanish.
And also be Italian. There's a lot of Italians in this one.
Dude. Oh, that it's probably Italian. Well, it's a Severelli picture, so it's probably Italian. You're probably right.
So Verona is in Italy, so I guess that makes sense.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, he had two uncredited roles. The first is my favorite in Romeo and Juliet. Complimentary role. Doesn't even have a title.
Wow.
And he was a Lucchese guard in The Godfather Part 3. Also uncredited. Okay. Great movie. Diane Venora. Sorry.
I was going to say, we said with through clenched teeth.
We'll get to another movie here shortly in the full circle that I'm sure we both adore. Diane Venora plays, she was Gloria Capulet in Romeo plus Juliet, or and Juliet, 96. And was Major Valentina Koslova in 97's The Jackal. We loved that too.
Huh. Of all things.
Of course, Leonardo DiCaprio was Romeo in Romeo and Juliet 96 and was Billy Costigan Jr. in 2006's The Departed.
Bingo cards. Oh boy. I won't go on about it. Moving on.
The shortest conversation we've ever had about that. Yep. M. Emmett Walsh was the apothecary who supplied the poison in Romeo and Juliet 96, and he was Bryant in 82's Blade Runner.
Oh shit! That yeah, that's right. It's like yeah. where the fuck have I seen him?
Miriam Margolis was the nurse in 96's Romeo and Juliet, and she was the dental nurse in 1986's Little Shop of Horrors. I believe she's the nurse that gets slammed in the face with a door during Steve Martin's song about being a dentist.
I believe so.
Yes. When I was watching it, I was like, where have I seen her before? And I was like, oh, she was the herbology professor in the Harry Potter movies.
That's it. That's what I was remembering.
Pete Postlethwaite was Father Lawrence in Romeo and Juliet 96. He was Father Brennan in the 2006 remake of The Omen. And bringing it back around to Clash of the Titans, he played Spiros in the 2010 version.
I honestly love that actor. He's been in some mixed things, but I think he's fantastic. I think he was fantastic in this one for sure. He was the only person who seemed like he was actually part of a Shakespeare production in the fucking movie.
He did. I was actually going to say that he felt very reserved, not just compared to the cast of the movie, but compared to the actor who played Father Lawrence in the Zeffirelli one from 68. Like, his line readings were really over the top.
Yeah. So. This guy's just got a voice on him. Like, he doesn't need to be over the top.
It's commanding and you listen.
Yeah.
Lastly for this, we have Vincent Loresca, who was Abra in 96's Romeo and Juliet, and he was just a random construction worker in 2012's The Amazing Spider-Man. Quite a downgrade, it seems.
Thank God. Like, what the hell? That's quite the jump there.
What happened to Mr. Loresca?
What happened to baby Loresca?
Whatever happened to... Oh, we should cover that. But that is full circle.
Cool. Before I take my, you know, typical drink of... A long drink of water after the synopsis, which thankfully this time around wasn't too hard. I will go ahead and say, going into this, I imagine you have a similar level... Unless you're a secret English major that I didn't know. We obviously don't have the tightest grip on like Shakespearean level language and that sort of thing. We are doing movie review and comparison shows. And from everything you've heard from us, we're not exactly high artists. So to that end, I will be doing the best I can with a lot of the themes of this. But a lot of it is going to be pretty surface level juvenile stuff of this one was silly in this moment and this one was stupid in this moment. So yeah,
this isn't hopefully you didn't go looking for movie podcasts and you're like, ooh, Romeo and Juliet, Shakespearean like reviewers. No. I like B-slasher movies. Sorry. I don't know the finer works of Shakespeare. I haven't read Timon of Athens. You know, I'm not
I like Western. I like Westerns, and I think I've seen Hunt for Red October at least 10 times. So take that for what you will.
There you go. Now that you're all caught up.
Mm-hmm. Any initial thoughts from you as I take my comical long drink of water?
Yes, yes. So the biggest thing that stood out to me, so speaking of Baz Luhrmann's career, Baz Luhrmann, obviously director of the 96 Romeo and Juliet.
Yes.
I had only seen one other movie he had directed prior to this, that being 2001's Moulin Rouge, which I do not like. Mm. So I was not expecting a lot going into this. And the first 10 minutes of the 96 movie were confirming my suspicions. I was like, oh, I hate this.
Yeah.
this is not for me. And that's primarily down to two things. The editing and the cinematography were horrendous. Like, mm-hmm. already they're going for a specific style, which just reading a sort of very general synopsis of it is Romeo and Juliet in modern day, but with the Shakespearean dialogue. That sounds like a fun premise. And it starts off, and it's a newscaster on a TV that's starting to zoom in, like reading off, you know.
Yeah, like the whole thing is being Verona, framed.
We lay our scene.
Yeah, the whole thing is being framed as like it doesn't, like I say framing, but it's being framed as kind of like an expose news story, which I honestly thought was pretty damn clever when I first saw it.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. I was liking it to a point because I thought that was fun. I thought the little analog TV was cute, and the fact that it was, you know, just the Shakespearean dialogue, I enjoyed that. And okay, I've been dragging this out too long. I actually do really like this movie. I like the 96 version. It's a lot of fun.
I should agree, like, early on, like, I like both of these movies. This isn't gonna be a fish in the barrel situation, just, you know, just to let you know.
Yeah, well, at least we got that out of the way. But I was tricked early on within the first 10 minutes of this movie, because the first confrontation scene to set the Capulet and Montague rivalry at hand takes place at a gas station. And there's all these wild, like, weird fast cuts and awkward zoom-ins on things. And I was like, is the whole movie going to be like this? Because this is obnoxious as hell. And then it calms down for a bit until it goes to Juliet's homestead with the lady of the house calling for Juliet and then the nurse running around. And she... There's these weird, like, zoom arounds that Lady Capulet does with the speed up of the camera, and she looks like she's from the Benny Hill show. And I don't know. I know we've talked about this in the past. I don't know if you're fine with the speed ups in movies or whatever when they do that, especially for comedic effect. I cannot watch anything with that effect on it without thinking of the Nostalgia Critic. And so I was like, this sucks. I hate this. This is awful.
Oh my God. I did not have any idea where that was going.
But after that, it's like, it doesn't happen ever again. I don't know what was on his mind or the editor's mind or whoever, when they were putting the beginning of this movie together, but they really kind of dropped the ball, because if I was not doing this for a podcast, I would have turned the movie off. I'm not kidding. Disservice to it, because I liked the rest of the movie. It was just annoying, and it wasn't even funny in like a, I'm a morbid curiosity. I got to keep watching. It was like hurting my eyes. I don't know.
I think there's a few levels. I think I understand necessarily why they did it. I think they were trying to give like the energy of that sort of lifestyle that was going on in that city. Like, they're definitely like Verona in this movie is meant to be, they call it Verona Beach. But it's meant to be like 1980s to 90s style Miami. And I think it does a good job of like creating that frenetic atmosphere right out the gate. But to that end, yeah, I do agree of like, I don't necessarily know why they needed to do a lot of that when then going forward into the movie. It is still very much a Shakespearean drama. Like, it does obviously have elements of, like, you know, obviously this is a very chaotic city still, and like the areas especially where they are, like Sycamore Grove and that sort of thing, that are still very real and meant to be, like, give this very dirty kind of drug addled haze to the whole thing, which kind of like gives, like, which kind of almost justifies why everyone's talking so weird. It kind of gives an implication of, like, this is like, if any, you know, non-Miami resident went down to like one of the rougher areas, they probably wouldn't understand any fucking word that anyone was saying anyway. So I do think to that end, it did a good job. And I am okay occasionally with the speed up stuff, especially when it's establishing a character. And I think they did that very well when they were establishing Lady Capulet. The problem being is that Lady Capulet is barely in this fucking movie. Like, it is centered on Romeo and Juliet primarily, and then a bit of Tybalt and Mercutio as the main secondary characters, with everyone else acting as kind of ways of propping up Romeo and Juliet. So I don't know why they needed to spend so much time creating the Capulet household in this way. It did it brilliantly if it were more focused on that household as a whole, but it really didn't. It was mainly just like, okay, yeah, this is a rich lady living in Miami in the 80s. Of course, it's going to be this, you know, love boat bullshit, like, on steroids. And so it just doesn't make sense why they spent so much time and effort to that end.
I think that's the main, I think that's my main issue, I guess.
Yeah. The rest of it is, with, like you said, it's very like reserved.
It's reserved, but it's still stylized. There's elements of this where it felt like, because I like the style of it. I like that it's modern and updated with the original dialogue, which is super niche. I even like, you know, the Romeo plus Juliet instead of just the and, which actually has been replicated by a couple of other Romeo Juliet remakes. Noticed there was one in like 2013, which I think had the plus in it. And I was like, is this specifically a remake of the 96 one? It's not. But it, anyways, you know, things like that. But then there are other moments where it felt like it was going a bit too far. And I was like, I enjoy the stylized nature of this, but if you push too hard in either direction, you're going to like ostracize the audience. And they're going to be like, what the fuck is this? Weird, yeah. John Waters shit that I'm watching. Not that he does stuff like that, but you know what I mean.
Right.
Like, specific style.
I will say, like, the amount of style that is just dripping off the 96 one, like, Baz Luhrmann is, like, as far as director, is hit and miss in the best of times, but he can make a movie that looks friggin' cool. Like, the amount that they go into the, like, the motif with, like, the cross and everything, like, obviously it's meant to be heavily going on that sort of gang life of, like, the, you know, the use of Christianity at the center of it and everything, and just like how much of a stranglehold it has, like, on that, those sorts of cultures, and so just that plus, like, you know, especially Tybalt's character, just like decked out in all of his shit. Like, John Leguizamo just like was just given the script in this and was like, all right, I'm gonna be the most buck wild man on screen and it's gonna be fantastic, and it was. With the possible exception, one beating him being Mercutio. and so, like, it was done beautifully, insanely in this, and I absolutely adore that. And my God, it's a breath of fresh air to how dry the original can be. This is a weird occasion. Like, this time around, I actually had to do it a bit differently. I started watching the 1968 version, got really bored with how the pace of things is going, and had to put on the 96 one as well to take a break. And then when the 96 one was being a bit too much for me, I had to switch back to the other one. And then I just kept doing that basically in pace with each other.
That's a hell of a way to watch a set of movies, to be honest.
If I had watched the 68 one alone, I would have taken 4 hours because I was so bored. And if I had watched the 96 one on its own, I would have needed to go outside and calm down.
So the 68 one is a little bland. It suffers solely from the fact that it's a straight adaptation of Shakespeare. And Shakespeare, the great thespian inventor of thousands of English words and whatever, what have you. I find that stuff a little boring, when it's just done straight like that, it looks like, you know, it looks like a Shakespeare play, but put on the movie. This is just, you know, me, a part of this generation, unable to focus on things like that. I need a little bit of style, like The Tragedy of Macbeth. I still need to see, and I want to see it because it looks stylish. It looks cool as hell. It's not in the same vein of something like the 96 Romeo and Juliet. It goes in its own direction, but at least there's something there added on to the prose of Shakespeare to keep me sort of interested. Otherwise, I do just feel like I'm in a high school language arts class, and maybe that is more of an indictment of the blandness of the school system than anything else. Which we see, because I know I never did Romeo and Juliet. I know the story through countless interpretations and references in other media, but I never had to read it in school. And I know a number of people not only read it, but they watched the 68 version in class. That's like a staple, but I never did that. We did Hamlet, which, you know, another stock Shakespeare play for sure.
Right. Ours is actually pretty fun. We actually ended up watching both of these movies in ours. So honestly, it was my earliest version of the show.
You watched the 96 one too?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
I definitely did not enjoy it back then. I think I didn't appreciate it in a way. I think I was still kind of in that mindset of like, isn't the point of Shakespeare meant to be that it's meant to be done faithfully? And then as I got older and realized, like, no, Shakespeare's entire point is that it's meant to be a very broad idea of it. And also, I'm sure Shakespeare himself would have absolutely loved the 96 version.
You can do whatever you want with the material as long as it gets the core points across. And
right. And to that end, I do agree with you. Like, I think with the exception of one point for the 6 day version of, I do enjoy it to the fact that it is able to basically have this entire kind of like town setting for it. I think it does a lot more for the story. I think it very much is like, if this was a story that actually happened, it would have happened like this. So I appreciate it for the kind of the authenticity to that end, but yeah, just like, it just drags on so, so long. And even the scenes where it doesn't necessarily drag, it does get kind of dull, especially when it's mainly just Romeo and Juliet on screen. Like, the Tybalt and Mercutio's on display in the 68 version were, like, my favorite part, bar none. Like, I think the Mercutio's in both these movies I adored.
The Mercutio is meant to be, in the story, sort of the comedic relief to an extent, because, you know, he's also played as the driving force behind a lot of the conflict.
Yeah.
Outside of, you know, the families hate each other, because Romeo wouldn't necessarily be involved to that degree without Mercutio's assistance. But
yeah,
I felt like it was weird, because for the amount of style in the new one and the amount of fun it felt like they were having, it also felt like they made Mercutio more of a serious character, which is odd to say, because, you know, it's this really
considering also that his first appearance on screen is in drag.
I was going to say he's sort of this drag performer that's jumping around all the bit, but he also has moments that maybe it just wasn't played right in the 68 film, and that's how you're supposed to interpret it. But these moments where he's like somber and crying, I didn't know that the entire dream monologue or the conversation the two of them have was supposed to end on that dour of a note. I understand the prose. I understand what's being said, but in the 96 version, it's almost upsetting. It's like, it almost felt in contrast to the rest of the movie. And I wonder if that was deliberate. It probably was. Most of it is.
I mean, I mean, even in the 68 one, it definitely ends on a pretty dour note. It's just not as, like, deeply emotional. Obviously, Mercutio is basically just, like,
I think it's the performer and the performance specifically that has me in that mindset.
Yeah. I do think the 96 one's probably the better actor for, like, a couple of reasons. Just, like, I think he's a very dramatic guy, and I think he's able to just bring that kind of energy that's really powerful. Probably the more original lore accurate Mercutio is the 68 one, sure, but I definitely enjoyed the 96 one more with him, because it's like every word he says and everything he ever does, he does it with such this performative bravado that's just a beauty to watch. just like every line he's like he ever delivers, it's just like, okay, yeah, no, this is fully what I expect this character to be like. And even if it's not, then fuck it, it's more fun.
One individual I really enjoyed, probably my favorite performance in the 68 version, is Pat Haywood as the Capulet nurse. I really,
oh my god, yeah, I was gonna
enjoyed
say
her performance. She was so much fun bouncing around. I had to look her up. This was her first film role, and she only did like 8 other movies after this. And I'm like, am I gonna like put these on a watch list and just watch them specifically for her? That's how much I enjoyed her presence, I guess.
Yeah. Like she just brings this like nice little energy to it. And it's like, she seems like the most genuine person here. And I'm sure she must have done stage Shakespeare before it, because she's among one of the better actors of the whole thing.
Oh, definitely. I know based on the research I did beforehand, she was married to the principal of some dramatic arts academy or something.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense.
So I know she was involved to that degree. She was great. Not to put down the nurse in the new one, because she also brings that same level of energy, I feel.
Oh yeah, like definitely it brings that kind of like that very what would be accurate to that area of like Miami, of like, you know, that very Latina nurse, which in many other movies would have been like very stereotypical, but it's very genuine and real in this, of like, oh yeah, like this seems like the most real character so far.
And I mean, she's a lot of fun. Of course, we have to mention Miriam Margolis. She is like a Brit playing a Hispanic woman, but you know,
as you do, it happens. Honestly, again, not necessarily the most controversial thing to happen in either of these movies.
No.
But to that end, because we've been talking about all these different characters and everything, how good did you think the people playing the actual title characters were in both cases? Because I'm going to just say it right out. I thought they were kind of eh.
Okay. Overall, compared to the rest of the supporting cast that sort of elevates the whole thing, I thought they were pretty eh too. But yeah. For specifics, if we want to... I'm sorry, I just blanked completely.
You're fine.
If we want to go into that.
Like, honestly, blanking completely, that's kind of like, honestly, playing the Romeo and Juliet characters in either of these movies. Because, my God, there were some moments where I looked at them and I just wanted to be like, line.
I'm 26. I shouldn't be having lapses in memory. But it's kind of divided for me because... both sets of them, they are the least interesting, you know, characters in the room, which isn't great. But interestingly enough, I don't know exactly how you felt on it, but the levels of performance that are brought to the table, if I had to pick one or the other, I prefer Olivia Hussey's Juliet from the 68 film to Claire Danes. She's fine, but I think Hussey does a better job. But I really liked To a Bland Character, but I much preferred DiCaprio's Romeo to Whiting's in the 68.
Yeah.
It felt like Whiting was a lot more subdued and less energetic, even in the playful scenes. Like, the most playful I can think of where it was actually like, oh, he's like in it, is there the funny scene where Romeo and Juliet meet up for the first time following the party at the church, and they keep kissing for like 5 minutes, and the father has to keep trying to get in between them, and it's like, yeah, he's pretty energetic there, but like, I don't know, even the fight scene, it was like, are you in it? Are you there? Are you present? You know?
Yeah. There's like a few, like two or three scenes where it seems like he took all of his emotion, like that one being in the church, the other being like when he first learns he's banished, where I was like, my God, man, get a grip.
Screaming in the catacombs.
I'm sure, like, and of course that's my favorite moment for the friar, of just being like, okay, bro, how's about you stop bitching and realize this is the best possible outcome to this situation and deal with it like a man. So I was like, that's always been my favorite part in either of those movies where Friar Lawrence just goes like, hey, shut the hell up.
You avenged Mercutio, you got a girl, you're not being put to death, you're in a movie, no less, directed by Zeffirelli.
Yeah.
You should be happy.
Yeah, I think I pretty much agree with you on your assessment there. I will say, like, obviously there's just a few scenes with, like, DiCaprio, especially the fucking extended scene where he's, like, he's obviously, they add an extra scene in it where he, like, he takes ecstasy before going to the party, and there's an extended scene of him just staring at a tank of fish, where I'm just like, how long, like, I do the thing where every now and again, and I've said it before and I have no shame of it, like, every now and again when things just kind of drag for me, I just have to, like, skip forward 10 seconds. I did it, like, 20 fucking times before he was away from that scene. I was like, how long is the fish staring?
He just did that on set.
Yeah, he wasn't even high, like, when he was filming. He just actually just did that. It's like,
implying that he would have gotten high on set otherwise. I mean, he was 21. He probably did. We all know the stories.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and, like, definitely, yeah, Hussey definitely played the better Juliet. I think she definitely seemed like she was the most, between the two of them, definitely was the most, like, actually in a Shakespeare play. She's definitely seemed, I'll always see that as probably the most accurate looking Juliet whenever I imagine it. You know, for what all it's worth, for my God, they were doing no favor. They were doing everything they could to show off her tits in, like, every scene. Yeah. Like, there were certain scenes I was like, Jesus, webbed, let them breathe at least. But yeah, and Whiting's, I'm just like, every scene he was in, I was like, man, I really hope something else happens.
Yeah. I feel strange saying this, but the benefit of that, going back to the tit talk.
Hello and welcome to my tit talk.
This is my tit talk.
We are 12.
What I wasn't really expecting, and solely because this being, even if it was on the tail end of the 60s, near the 70s, it was still the 60s, so I wasn't entirely expecting it, but you get full-on man-ass. And I was like, you know what? There you go. Do it for both, not just female sexualization, you know? You get Whiting's ass, too.
Hell yeah, break that glass ceiling with that pasty man-ass. I say pasty. He was not pasty. He was, like, I'll give him credit. He was in shape.
Oh, better shape than me.
Jesus wept.
But
you get, of course, everybody was showing off whatever they had with those outfits and everything, like, between the skin tight things for the men and then, like, the bodices for women. Jesus. It's weird that the 96 one had less TNA than the original.
It did, and you feel like there'd be more? With the drag performances and the excess of drugs and stuff like that, you know?
It's
the 90s. Miami in the 90s.
Yeah. Like, shit. Of course, and just every time I kind of think back to it, it's like, God, the 96 one, I did adore its style. Having been to real world Miami, I honestly was like, yeah, this is exactly what I imagined it. And I feel like living here would be living in a circle of hell.
People of Florida.
I mean, like, Miami is such a weird fucking city specifically. It looks like, I think I've described it before. I don't know if I've described it on the show. It looks like if someone took a, like, 1960s World's Fair that was, like, centered on, like, oh, the city of the future, and then they just kept growing it and then never washed it. That's what Miami looks like. And also, it's humid beyond belief. So it's like, no wonder all that shit would get, be it was happening there. Everyone was like, I'm so fucking hot, I need to just be high.
I like the touch that when the fight is taking place on the beach, there's just trash and, like, broken glass everywhere. Because I was like, yeah, I've been to Miami once for three hours as I was passing through. We stopped to eat. It is a shithole. I'm sorry, but...
Yeah, it's a shithole. Like, I mean, if y'all live in Miami and love it, like, God bless you. But yeah, your place is weird and kind of trashy. And, like, honestly, I've had a certain pride of living in trashy places. There's a certain part to it. It's like, hey, it's not trying to put up any airs, at least.
I mean, you get that when you either live in big to relatively big cities or notable areas or just outside of them. I used to live 20 minutes outside of St. Louis, and I lived in a decent area, but you drive 10 miles and it is, you know, the city. That's how cities are, just in general.
And, like, And going back and kind of going to that point that you said, and I've brought it up on the show before, but the entire idea of, I think it was in the Jacob's Ladder one, but like the set dressing that you'd get in the 90s and everything, they really remembered to like make it look like a place that existed, and rather than it being like this IKEA catalog fucking spick and span Instagram story place. And yeah, it looks legit. Everything there, it looks like, you know, even the Capulet Mansion, there's bric-a-brac and random items and all these different things. It looks like a real place that all of this is taking place in, especially the beach, Sycamore Grove area. It was fantastically made. And also a fact I learned about it was that apparently, A, they made all the sets for it, especially there at the beach, and B, it was all eventually destroyed partway through filming because of a hurricane. And during the Mercutio fight scene, you actually see like all the wind and everything whipping up. That was actually the beginnings of the hurricane coming in.
Good word.
Yeah, which I saw that. I was like, oh, that's cool. But yeah, they made it look like legitimately like this trashy place and everything, like with a big pane of glass that he gets thrown into, like the burned down like outdoor theater that they're fighting in and everything. It was just like, it was pretty freaking fantastic.
Yeah, it's like I could go there, you know.
Yeah,
would I want to? I don't know about that, but I could, not like, know, but like I yeah. could visit.
It's yeah, like, and like, you know, all the crowds and everything they had, like the crowds that they had during that fight scene, especially, like they had them playing brilliantly, like kind of chiming along and jibing in with everything, like reacting appropriately to comments that when I would hear them would be like, is that meant to be like an ooh got him moment, or is that meant to be an oh is this is actually a very dramatic thing he's saying? Because it's hard to tell.
It gets lost a little bit. There are some elements of the 96 version where if you, I guess it doesn't matter because it's a stylized retelling of Shakespeare, and if you're watching this movie, if you have the means to watch this movie, you know what Shakespeare is and you know what Romeo and Juliet is, you know? So it's near impossible to actually ostracize someone with this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just funny watching it because there's some moments like the entire stipulation, which the story is sort of dependent on, of Romeo's banishment makes a little less sense in a more updated setting because it's like, we don't really do that anymore.
Yeah, no, like, I guess there's, like, I think maybe the explicit thing would be, like, if someone's, like, just wanted by the police, like, but even then, there's not, like, the explicit thing of, like, oh, if we find him, if we see him, he's going to be arrested. It's like, no, we go looking for them, at least.
Yeah. it's like, Prince needs to be doing his fucking job. Like, he's...
Yeah.
He's like, an actual prince. He like, you know, corrupt police. He, like, controls Verona Beach.
There obviously there's plenty of plot holes going throughout the thing of just like, you know, having certain scenes and everything of like having to have gun, like basically gun sword play, which again Leguizamo does beautifully with like how he holds his gun and everything. He holds it like a rapier, which like no one else really does to that degree, so I think he definitely stands out to that end. But it, again, I really don't mind it that much because, again, all the very accurate stuff kind of eventually just kind of blurred into the background with the 68 version, where I was just kind of like, all right, cool. It looks like I'm watching a fucking, you know, it looks like I'm watching a documentary at times.
Yeah.
Or like a reenactment documentary, rather.
I think for me, it is the style. And again, I love the movie. I think some of those moments just stand out to me because of the specific style that they're going for. And it was not intended, but I couldn't help but laugh, to be honest, at the follow-up scene after Mercutio's death. Leonardo DiCaprio is screaming at the top of his lungs in a car and just causes a huge wreck. I was laughing the whole time.
Yeah, no, it's like the tone is so all over the place in the 96 version. Like, my God. But I will say, at least it doesn't have a really like constantly present, really annoying like tune that they establish in the 68 one. My God, that song got stuck in my head when I watched it in ninth grade, and my God, it's been stuck ever since.
I think I might be on the opposite end where it's kind of odd, but and I might be in the minority on this, but I don't, that's also kind of laughable to me, and not personally, not in a good way. I kind of wish the same way they did with the dialogue, they went for a more theatrical score. I saw what they were doing in the 96 one with sort of these poppy songs that are thrown in throughout, but I don't know, something about the children's choir singing Prince at one point, I was like,
yeah,
I kind of wish they went in a different direction for this. And that kind of, I don't know, because Moulin Rouge kind of does the same thing, and I'm like, Baz Luhrmann and his team, you know, whoever he pulls together for these movies, they're really great at these set dressing in these environments. But I hate the characters, I hate the story, and I hate the music in Moulin Rouge.
Yeah. And he's got sort of the, he must have deal. He has a weird fascination with like integrating modern music into kind of older styles. Like he does it a bit in Great Gatsby as well. But to at least to the point where in this one it's actually like he takes like he gets like artists who did like, you know, actual songs, but then he puts them to like 1920s and 30s like ragtime style music, and it actually works pretty well. But that's definitely the minority.
It's definitely
in the minority instead of just like all these like randomly thrown in. At least this one it was that way, it was integrated in a little, but not so much in this one.
Yeah, I if we have to, because I everything I'm bringing up is kind of a nitpicky. I am a really big fan of the 96 one, so I felt I did have to bring that up. I don't like the music, and I kind of wish they went in a different direction, personally. Personal taste.
I think ultimately we've kind of shown our hands a bit, just for the sheer amount that we've talked about the 96 one, because I wanted to like the 68 more than I did, but God, like, it's only about 20 minutes longer, but Christ alive, it feels more than that. It's just... The 96 one obviously doesn't stick around too long, and like it probably could have added more dialogue from the original play, but honestly I remember it more. I remember it more than the 68 one. Entire scenes went by in the 68 one where I was like, okay, moving on.
Well, yeah, that's the problem. From a directorial standpoint, the 68 one does well at what it sets out to do, just in the fact that it is a cinematic retelling of a Shakespeare classic. There's a reason, like I said, why I was surprised you actually saw the 96 one in school. I have heard from numerous people that they watched this movie in school because it's just, you know, it's the play on the screen.
Yeah.
And, you know, they do a good job at replicating what the sets would look like, and they get the characters in there, even though a lot of them are kind of bland, in my opinion. But I've already praised... Olivia Hussey as Juliet. I praised Pat Haywood as the nurse. I didn't praise Milo Shea as Friar Lawrence a lot, but I do like his deliveries. Especially the scene where he's chastising Romeo.
Mainly just because it's like it's almost wish fulfillment at that point, where it's just like, just smack this dumbass already.
Exactly, and that's sort of what I was getting at. Where Pete Postlethwaite is. In a similar sense, good at what he does, but I do prefer the Friar Lawrence in the original, because it feels like he's, I don't know, it feels like he's more present in the environment, and he's hamming it up a bit in the acting, which maybe isn't inherently good, whereas Pete Postlethwaite in the 96 one feels more like a real priest. So it's odd for me to prefer the other version than the one that's more accurate. I don't know.
It's also weird that the very real seeming priest is also kind of dabbling in like chemistry in his back rooms and shit. Like, I know that they ultimately get the poison from the apothecary, but like still, well, no, I think he makes the fake poison for Juliet. And of course we have that scene where he's first introduced, where he's doing like chemistry in front of these kids. And I'm like, this feels weird. This like feels like this guy is actually like, which honestly isn't too absurd to believe that, like, you know, this priest is also secretly a straight up drug manufacturer, but it's like,
yeah,
it doesn't really expand on that much. It just does that scene just to justify why later he has the fake poison.
Right. No, that's true. I hadn't really thought about that or considered that.
Like, if they had leaned into that more and they made him kind of like this kind of morally gray character, it would have been kind of interesting, I feel like, but also would have been even more amount of tone tossed under the bus. So I think we're fine with what we got.
Yeah, you know what, let's count our blessings and
yeah. And it's like, I got it's like, and I'm sure we could go into a deeper analysis if we had truly any idea of how to do that with Shakespearean level language. I got to tell you, I understood this more than when I first read it / watched it in high school. Still understood maybe 60% of what was going on with what people were saying.
I mainly got the gist of it.
Yeah, I got the gist. And obviously synopses help. But again, it's so crazy just looking at the synopsis compared to the length of these movies, because the synopsis is honestly pretty freaking simple. But the movie, like the play itself, God, it does not know when to shut up. And I know that's the point. Like, it was in a time when we didn't exactly have the idea of trope, so they had to establish a lot of stuff on their own. But shit, man.
Saying this as a last bit, not to drag things out, but this is less an indictment of the two movies as well, but just the play as a whole. But it's important because it's used to drive the point of Juliet faking her death. But the entire, like, forced marriage with Paris has always felt forced in the story to me. I'm like, we could probably do without all this, and I would be willing to say that wholeheartedly if it wasn't for the fact that that is the reason she fakes her death, is one, to get Romeo's attention, but also to not go through with the marriage that is being forced on her by her father. But still, I don't know, maybe that could have been done some other way, because the character doesn't feel fully utilized. That actually feels like something like The Wizard of Oz had Wicked. Like, there's a Romeo and Juliet retelling out there through Paris's point of view. How's he reacting to all this craziness? It's the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, true. I think ultimately, and obviously look at us like dissecting the writing quality of a 600-year-old play now. But I think a lot of it just kind of goes into the old school concept of like that chivalrous love, like courtly love, of like there is inevitably some kind of thing that separates those two lovers who are truly destined for each other. Hence that also being a story that they really don't illustrate enough in a lot of the, you know, wider interpretations. This is a story that takes over the course of a day and a half, maybe, or like maybe 2 days, of like this dude Romeo was all butthurt because he didn't get with this other girl that he wanted to be with, who was never even shown on screen, I'm pretty sure. And then immediately falls head over dick for Juliet at this party. A point that I think possible, I can't remember if the 68 one had the line delivery like this as well, but Postlewaite's version of it was definitely like, you know, clearly men are not driven by their eyes, but with their heart, or sorry, are not driven with their heart, but with their paws, eyes. It's like, he meant dick.
And that was probably in the original Shakespeare version.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess to that end, like, obviously the writing of it, like, it definitely recognizes, like, okay, yeah, this is a whirlwind affair. But even still, like, the whole thing, if it's meant to be like, oh, you know, the true boundaries of, like, you know, the true nature of love is fast and strange. And, like, once you know you're truly in love, that's it. You're done. And so I think judging it by modern standards has always been kind of a losing battle. But to that end, yeah, it does seem like at certain points, the Paris backstory bit was definitely in there specifically to bring up the driving point at the end. Because otherwise, you know, Romeo's banished and now Juliet's just kind of on her own, has to wait a little bit before getting spirited away to a different place. And then they wait and then they can come back and then they're safe again. It's like, that's not an engaging story. That's just like, okay, yeah, we got to have some reason for this to be a tragedy.
Right. I feel like that's important dissecting any media after revisiting it after a long period of time, is you can bring up the critical aspects or your thinking on it, whether you think it works or it doesn't work, but you should also try to have some context or provide context. That's why I've always hated shit like people get mad when you talk about Mario 64 and you're like, it doesn't hold up because the controls are bad. They're like, it was the first of its kind. You have to judge it by the standard then. It's a 100 out of 100, 10 out of 10 game.
Yeah.
It's like, well, I understand the context, but Ocarina of Time is incredibly hard to go back to and not necessarily fun. You know,
and I think you and I have also established with this show, especially, we don't really subscribe to the whole idea of like this super bullshit, like, you know, pompous way of judging things. Of We basically just go by, did we enjoy this, yes or no? And that's how I think a lot of media should be consumed at a certain point. To that end, also, it doesn't mean you should just straight up damn anything that doesn't meet that quality. And like recognize that, okay, yeah, in context, this is why it was. That doesn't necessarily mean I enjoyed it when I watched it, though. So it's like, right. Objectively, it's a stupid plot point that could have done with better fleshing out. So
yeah, there's a time and place for everything, and critical analysis is definitely important in regards to any form of media that's produced, or art, whatever you could consider, but that's not really what our show is. Our show is basically, when you boil down to it, like, it started out being straight up comparing the two movies, you know, what did they do different, but the driving force of our show at this point is, which one did we like, which one did we dislike, or which one did we like more, and then comparing the two just to describe why we liked or hated something, you know. Yeah. So it's all about our personal tastes at the end of the day.
Yeah.
There's just critical analysis is kind of secondary as a...
We are a critical analysis for the everyman. We are the critical analysis of people who just truly could not give less of a damn about this whole thing of, like, shot structure and, like, mise-en-scene and all this other bullshit. Like, they're all things that we have learned about in the brief amount of time we've taken classes on it. And we both kind of agreed on the fact of, okay, that's all pompous bullshit. Let's just talk about it like normal human beings.
I took that class to watch movies. That's the only reason I took that class.
Same, honestly. And then I realized, like, oh god, these movies are actually really dull. And
I liked 2 of the 10 things we watched.
Yeah, that class was our villain backstory.
Yes,
I thought we liked film. No, we like movies. That is the thing that we need to. I feel like if we ever needed a subtitle for this fucking show, it's we don't like film. We like movies, and that's because like. We're not filmmakers. We've never really had the desire for either of us. I can't really speak to your end. Like, I've wanted to make stories and stuff, but never wanted to, like, do film as a thing. And it's just this whole concept of, like, having such a high and mighty attitude about it is just so old school at this point. Like, man, just let people just enjoy shit or don't enjoy shit and then move the hell on.
It's gotten to the point where I don't even like to use the word film if I can help it. Sometimes it slips out due to conditioning, but it's just such a pompous word. I just use the word movie, or I'll use pictures. I've been using pictures more recently. I think since what is that director's name? He used to call things pictures all the time. Paper Moon. He just died.
I have no idea. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'll look it up real quick.
To that end, like I use film to describe the industry, like film as like a thing, as like a wider industry thing. And I use movies to describe like the individual actual like thing you pay money to go either to a theater or have in your home to watch. It's like the difference between theater spelled E-R or theater R-E. It's like theater is a E-R is a building. Theater R-E is the art form.
Fair, understandable. Peter Bogdanovich, by the way,
is the name.
I've been using picture a lot more recently, thanks to him.
I do love that. It's always like I do love the every now and again we just have these diatribes at the end of these movies when it's very clear how we feel one way or the other, because it's like, you know, we have our answer for that. Like I'm gonna say I like the 96 one better, but just kind of objectively.
I like the 96 one better too.
Yeah, it's more fun. I remembered it better. I'd probably watch it again, honestly.
I think that these episodes are the really good ones. The ones where at the end we go on a diet, and it's not even necessarily a tangent, even though it is, because it's tied in. It's tied into what we're discussing. Like I remember, you know, we had a really like a 25-minute long one. Holy shit. For the Seven Samurai one, but it was related to what we were discussing and movies as a whole. And this one is shorter than that, but it's in the same vein where it spurred this specific conversation.
Yeah, where we're the counterculture voices in this world of, you know, constant criticism of all these different things. Like, we're just here to give a basic level opinion and encourage people to have basic level opinions. Like.
Yeah.
Movies are not gonna get better until we kind of get back to that point. Like, it really we need to kind of remember, yeah, like the statement, everyone's a critic. Maybe everyone shouldn't be a critic at the end of the day. Maybe everyone should just have a couple opinions and then just, like, you know, say I like this, say I don't, and have really petty reasons for it. I don't like the 68 version because all the hats people are wearing are absurd and stupid.
Well, okay, I don't agree with that, but you're entitled to have it, and there you go. That's how
exactly.
We...
It's like, no, and I honestly, it's like, and it's joking, obviously, more than anything, but I still think they're silly. Yeah.
I mean, I saw something similar to that recently, because there's always the discussion around Rotten Tomatoes, which I don't actively use or frequent, regarding critic reviews based on comparing that to audience reviews, and how it's like critics are so out of touch, they don't know what we the people want. And I saw one of those, and sometimes I agree with that, but I saw one of those recently where it was like negative critic reviews for Free Guy and positive audience scores, and it's like, see, the critics don't know what we the people really want. I was like, I don't want Free Guy. I don't want that.
Yeah, I don't know what people saw Free Guy and thought that was anything other than hot garbage. I don't get that at all. Like, well, what the hell?
They're like, they saw Free Guy too, so fuck us.
They saw the fucking Captain America reference and they were like, oh my god, my pants.
my pants.
Like, if take that, interpret that however you want. I don't know. Again, I blame Marvel for everything. But it's like, if you guys want like a cool like movie about existential questions about living in a fake reality, fucking watch The Truman Show. It's better, and we don't have the whole like bullshit thing of like the whole thing is just driven because this dude's horny for this player and this player is horny for an NPC. It's like, it's got a love thing, and it's actually tragic and strange. It's like, it's actually deep, and there's like asking questions about morality and like what it is to live under the will of, basically asking the question, why would Adam and Eve want to leave the Garden of Eden? It's like a super deep story with fucking Jim Carrey of all people at the helm of it, who's a fantastic actor.
It's a Jim Carrey movie, a comedy actually, at its even if it's dramatic at its core, it's a comedy, and it's one that I actually really like. I'd say that and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind are probably my two favorite Jim Carrey movies. You know, leave the 94 stuff in the past. and Sonic the Hedgehog.
Of course.
But yeah, no, I tend to agree, and everyone's getting in on that train nowadays. Our boy, Leonardo DiCaprio, who we just talked about, I know that he's currently the producer on both an upcoming Captain Planet movie that's in production. I know everyone wants to see that. And the Akira remake that's been in hell for like 2 decades.
What?
He is now producer on. So,
hey, I mean, all right. Shit. I mean, I'm excited to see Akira at least.
Yeah, if it comes out, we'll get it's always strange because sometimes I see those remakes and I'm like, they really shouldn't remake that, but I fucking hope they do. Because then we can do an episode on it, and I can talk about Akira.
It's like, hooray!
So,
that the monkey's paw of this show is like, man, I sure would love to watch this this movie, and then they remake it, and so now we have to. obviously, we don't have to do any.
You don't
movies.
Have to. It's up to us.
You get that evil out of here. You dare not speak his power phrase.
Oh
God. Yeah, here we are at the hour whatever mark of having had this diatribe, and of course it ends with Nostalgia Critic.
But yeah, we stated our points. We had a slight tangent cast, not really, but also really.
It's effective to the point that we've ultimately wanted to make with this show, like, which is honestly kind of the best possible place it could have gone, rather than us just becoming bitter and like really nitpicky about shit. We're like, no. Let's have genuine human opinions and not have the worry of like, oh, we got to like, you know, satiate like a publisher or like a sponsor or whatever to have like really hard edged opinions. It's like, no, we encourage you all to have your own damn opinions about it. We're two geriatric old men in young men's bodies just talking about random bullshit.
And no, I mean, that's it. That's a good enough point. Yeah, for that. We have nothing to add on to that.
Exactly. And the joy of it is, we don't have to add on to it.
Oh,
we can just go on to socials.
I was going to say, if there's nothing else, I guess we'll head on to socials. But you can go ahead and subscribe, like, follow, leave a review on any podcasting platform of your choice. We are on YouTube, Podomatic, Spreaker, Podbay, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, iTunes, Google Play, of course, but our host is Anchor. You can listen to us on there as well, or make your own podcast. It's pretty easy. We do it.
Good shit.
Go ahead and if you have any thoughts on potential future episodes that you might want us to cover, if you just have thoughts about the podcast, negative and positive, go ahead and send us an email, theyremadeit@gmail.com. And go ahead and follow us at @itremade on Twitter for updates about potential future episodes, news when podcasts or episodes are coming out, full circle diagrams, posters on what we've been watching recently, things like that, of that nature. And I believe that is it.
Yeah, just as always, we welcome your opinions, good and bad, big and small. You know, obviously, like we said, that's kind of the unstated point of this show at this point is, you know, having opinions and them not being like, you know, Twitter breakingly like controversial for some reason.
Yeah, sometimes our opinions are straight up dog shit bad.
Yeah, but who cares? You can have a wrong opinion. We often have wrong opinions.
I have plenty.
Yeah. It's okay to be wrong. Like, my God. Just makes my life more interesting at a certain point. Nothing wrong to the point of, like, endangering others, though, because, like, you know, there's certain people. Won't get into that. the modern era. It's just such a well-loving and even-tempered place, isn't it?
Yeah. So much better than that ancient Shakespearean era.
Yeah, imagine people getting ousted and thrown to the wolves and all these different things and having whirlwind love affairs that go nowhere and... I should book another appointment with my therapist here soon. It's getting too real.
Oh.
Well, thank you, Romeo and Juliet, for just reminding us our mortality, morality, one of the two. Anyway.
Both.
Both, yeah. Why was there just like a pane of glass in that theater anyway? I literally had that, that thought of like, he got thrown into that when I was watching the movie. I was like, why is there just glass? What am I on about?
I don't know.
It's been a minute. I'm sorry. I'll go ahead and let you guys go free. As always, I am your host, Stuart.
And I'm your host, Jacob.
Have a good night. I'd give some sort of, like, quippy Shakespearean send-off, but remember, I'm stupid and not an English major.
Slain Tybalt, would thy slay thyself and slay thy lady that on thy life lives by doing damned hate upon thyself?
Rousey man.
Thy Juliet is alive. There art thou happy. Tybalt would kill thee, but thou slewest Tybalt. There art thou happy. The law that threatened death becomes thy friend and turns it to exile. There art thou happy. A pack of blessings light upon thy back.